Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Talking defines part of what makes us human. We're almost constantly in dialogue, but to what end? What purpose does all this conversation serve, both for individuals and for society? And what's happening in our brains when we talk? Well, Shane O'Mara has been thinking about those questions for his book, Talking Heads, The New Science of How Conversation Shapes Our Worlds. So welcome to you.
And thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So let's just start with the mechanics, if we can, because you've got some interesting stuff on what's happening in our brain when we have a conversation. Can you talk us through the rather surprisingly brief interactions we tend to have?
Yeah, so obviously we talk a lot, but we talk to other people. But what we're not very good at doing is understanding just how complicated our conversations with others are and what the kind of the elements of those conversations are. So just to give you a simple example, in order to have a dialogue, we have to take turns. That means we have to switch between one speaker and another, and one person has to listen to what the other person has to say, and vice versa. And the switch between one speaker and another, on average, is about 200 milliseconds. That is about a fifth of a second. In other words, we're responding in conversation about as quickly as it is possible for the nervous system to respond to anything. Prototypical example that we give is the runner at the Olympics getting going when they hear a report from a starting pistol. That's how quick our responses are in conversation.
Right, and that's just day in, day out without even thinking about it.
Not just day in, day out, moment in, moment out.
Right, and then what other elements of conversation have you been able to identify? I mean, one of the interesting things I thought was that we anticipate. The reason we could do it so quickly is we anticipate what people are about to say.
Yeah, so conversation would be impossible without prediction. We're able to predict what people are about to say. You can do this in a variety of different ways. One is to measure electrical activity in the brain and use that to kind of predict what the person that you're listening to is about to say. And we do this all the time in conversation, but we're not really aware of it. But when one person is speaking to you, you have to mobilize all the information that you have about the topic that you're engaged in. You have to focus your attention on that topic. You must get the words in the correct order so the motor programming must work. And then you must speak. In other words, to do this, you have to have a whole lot of things, processes going on at once. You're multitasking. And in order to understand where the conversation is going, you must be predicting it ahead of time. It's not a passive process. It's a really active process. Active inference is the phrase that's sometimes used.
I don't know if there's any research on this, but I can imagine if you were talking to someone from an entirely different culture, you know, China, let's say, which is, you know, has quite different values and understandings to the West. If a Westerner was talking to a Chinese person, would the conversation take longer? Because they can't anticipate quite as easily what their interlocutors can say.
I don't know that there's any research on that, but any research on it would be confounded by the lack of fluency or otherwise of the one person and the other in the other's native language.
You'd be two bilingual people. Yeah.
You have to assume two bilingual people, in which case then you're going to be confounded by the fact that you will have absorbed at least some of the assumptions of the other person's language and community in learning their language. So that's a really difficult one to tease apart.
What about what's happening in the brain and the technology for scanning brains as we talk and, you know, as we feel things and listen to things and say things? What are we learning from that new technology that enables us to see inside the brain?
Yeah, so there's been an absolute revolution in the last 20 or 30 years in technologies that allow us to see into the brain while the brain is at work. And one of the remarkable things is that we see, or we can see millisecond by millisecond, the kinds of activity that occurs in differing brain areas. So to give you a very simple example, if you're listening to somebody else speaking, you can see a sequence of activity that comes obviously through activations through the ears into the auditory areas of the brain, but you also see activity in other parts of the brain that are involved in paying attention, that are involved in memory, and all of those kinds of things. And they're all happening simultaneously, and they allow you to participate in and keep the conversational thread. And given the fact that we speak to each other so easily, so fluently, so easily all the time, keeping conversational threads doesn't seem to be a very difficult thing to do. But if you're paying only partial attention to what the other person is saying, you can sometimes fill in the bits that you've missed. We've all had the experience in classrooms being picked on by a teacher where we've been looking out the window or whatever, and we've managed to fill in from the last two or three words that the teacher has said to us where we're supposed to be in the lesson or whatever. But in the case of dementia and in the case of certain types of brain damage, these processes actually become remarkably difficult. And the holding attention to the conversational thread, understanding what it is that the person you're speaking to is expecting to get from you in the conversation and maintaining that through time, turns out actually to be something that is very, very sensitive to damage to particular brain areas.
I don't know if you heard the radio reports or read about the recent research on Pink Floyd's Brick in the Wall being played to some people and the brain scan being taken of what people were, how they were receiving that music, and then recreating from the brain scan the music, which was sort of muddy and not quite there, but definitely the same song.
In a sense, that's not entirely surprising. There's been a kind of a drive to try and recreate, it's called neural decoding, what it is that the brain sees when you're played stimuli like this. And this has been done for short sequences of movies, for example, and other things over the last few years. And it has been known for quite some time that if you put electrodes into certain parts of the inner ear, I don't need to go into the details, you can get a reasonably high fidelity decoding of the auditory stimulus that the person is listening to, so what it is that they're hearing. And we shouldn't be entirely surprised by this, but equally we shouldn't be terribly scared by this. The techniques that are used are highly invasive. They require lots and lots of participants, and they take a very, very long time to extract the signal from the noise. So I think worries about cognitive privacy, which I think are reasonable in this case, don't really terribly apply.
Right, but you can imagine a day when, you know, if the technology improves, which generally it tends to do, that someone could watch your brain activity and work out what you're thinking.
Yeah, but there's an easier way to do that, and that's to have a conversation with you.
Well, yes.
And it's a much cheaper way, and it's a much more effective way.
I was going to get onto that, because you do talk about the value of rapport and that being a way of getting the truth out of a conversation. But the fact is that people can resist it, and all those criminals who say they're not guilty when in fact they are guilty, and they stick to their story. I mean, it's not like conversation always works in that respect, is it?
No, that's absolutely true. But let's go back just for a moment to the invasion of your privacy for a second. To make these kinds of experiments work, you have to have cooperative subjects. You have to have people who aren't moving when they're in the scanner. You have to have a whole lot of things in place beforehand. And if you want to confound the imaging, it's really easy. All you have to do is change the rate at which you breathe. All you have to do is deploy your attention somewhere else. All you have to do is nip your tongue. All you have to do is squeeze your hand. There are lots and lots of ways of throwing this off and in ways that you can't recover the signal. So I think this idea that we're going to be, you know, hooked into Neuralinks and Elon will be listening into us is really for the birds. It's not going to happen. Now, just to come to the rapport for a moment, it is clearly the case that there is an image out there of criminals who will want to stick to their story. However, I think there's been a revolution in the way that policing addresses this issue over the last 30 to 40 years, and it's been led principally by investigators in the UK, resulting from the Police and Criminal Evidence Act in the early 1980s. And the consequence has been that police forces, the Irish police forces like this, the Norwegian police force is the same, the UK, has, as I said, has been the leader in this, are not seeking confessions. What they're seeking to do is to get the person to tell their story. And they do this in ways that are not oriented towards confession-based evidence. What they're trying to do is to probe the person through the course of an interview in a respectful way to tell their story. And the data actually on this are really quite remarkable. Most people, most of the time, are cooperative, and most people, most of the time, will speak, and most people, most of the time, will happily give up the rights under the law not to speak in order to be heard. And we humans have this kind of prepotent response when we're asked questions. It's remarkably difficult to suppress, especially when you're having a close encounter like that, your natural urge to give your side of the story. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. We see actors doing it on television, but that doesn't reflect the reality of investigative interviewing in police stations.
I did interviews on the radio for, you know, I've been doing this for sort of 30 years. And one of the things I noticed is if you stay silent, even with quite a sort of, you know, quite a hostile interview, we're trying to hold someone to account, maybe, the interviewee is desperate to fill the silence. People cannot bear the silence. It may be partly because it's on the radio and they're aware of that. But it seems to me, what is the role of silence in conversation?
Yes, yeah, so there's a small literature on what's called the strategic role of silence in interviewing. And the idea is very simple, that when you're interviewing somebody, and you've already intuited this from the work that you've been doing, that not speaking when you're interviewing is just as important as speaking. An NCIS investigator I know says regularly to people he trains, you have two ears and one mouth, so listen twice as long as you speak, which I think originally goes back to Epictetus or Cicero or somebody. But the urge to speak, to fill the silence, really is something that is very, very difficult for people to resist. And just that moment of dead air, as you would have it in the on the airwaves, or dead time where there's just nothing and the person who's speaking is very comfortable to just sit there and wait for you, is a very, very difficult thing to resist. So deploying silence appropriately is a really good prompt to elicit speech, paradoxically.
There was a presenter who was Irish, actually, like you, Terry Wogan in the UK, who used to try and leave silences as long as he could in his radio programmes, because he thought it was good radio and it made the listener fill in the gap, as it were. But actually, there's a technical problem with it. With these radio stations now, if there's dead air for, I think it's over 8 seconds, the whole thing closes down. So you can't really do it. Anyway, what about, which I guess is related to this, conversation and trust. You were talking about that in the book.
Yeah, so I guess something that's underrated in modern society is the extent to which we trust each other. And this conversation we're having today is a very, very good example of this. You and I have never met each other before. This is the first time we're going to have first time we've had a conversation together. And we used an intermediary to meet up with each other. So there's a small chain of trust that was extended between us in order for this to happen. And in turn, we rely upon a whole variety of technologies to ensure that this podcast will end up being available to other people. So we trust. We trust when we walk out the front door that the footpath isn't going to collapse, that the local council have built it to the appropriate standards. When we take the train to work, we trust in the driver having been trained to the appropriate standard. And this trusting in others is something that happens from a very, very early point in life. There's a famous book on child development called Trusting What We Hear, written by Paul Harris a number of years ago. And that there used to be this idea that we should think of children as scientists on a small scale, testing hypotheses about their world. And Harris's point, and the point that many other developmental psychologists make, is that that can't be true. Children don't go about the world discovering things afresh for themselves. Instead, what they do is they ask other people and they trust what other people say. So I give the simple example in the book of an elder saying to a child, "Don't eat those yellow berries. They're poisonous." The child probably won't eat them. The elder probably isn't a toxicologist. It may not be true that the yellow berries are poisonous. We don't know. But we will avoid them because we've been told to avoid them, because we invest our trust in people in particular that we have a social relationship with.
We're going to talk later on about the role that conversation plays in building communities and institutions and even countries, nations. But just before that, slightly less importantly, perhaps, gossip has a role in regulating behaviour, you argue. Tell us about gossip.
Yeah, so gossip is really, really important. And people give gossip a kind of a hard rap that they really probably shouldn't give it. So what do I mean by that? So let's imagine that you're going to work somewhere new. What do you want to do? What you want to do is find out quickly who's up, who's down, who you can trust, who can get jobs done, who tells you that they will get jobs done and then does nothing. All of those bits and pieces of tacit, implicit information that aren't written down in the formal documentation associated with the organization. And this is true in life generally. When you join a new sports club, you want to know who will get things done. Will the subscription secretary actually do their job, or is it actually somebody else who takes over from them, or whatever it happens to be? So we rely on gossip all the time as a kind of a cognitive shortcut to allow us to live our lives much more easily. It's a good heuristic, but we mistake gossip in its benign sense and gossip in its malign sense. So we think of gossip as something where one person is telling untruths about another. And there is lots and lots of observational data to show that that's not true. But there's also a twist to gossip, which I think is really fascinating. And it's this, that we humans mentalize. And by that, I mean, we think about what other people are thinking. And we do this all the time. And we do it to a remarkable degree. We worry about what other people think about us. And gossip is a really good way of regulating our own behavior, because we don't want other people to speak to others badly of us, because we know that that will corrode our position in society. So gossip actually is antithetical to secrets and secret keeping. It's a really good way of piercing silences. And it's one that we kind of underestimate in our societies at large.
Now then, another thing you talk about in the book, I wasn't sure it was sort of, yeah, it's important to conversation, but also to so much else. I wasn't sure quite what you were saying about it, but memory and conversation. I mean, you can't really have conversations without memory, but there are lots of things you can't do without memory, right?
Yeah, so what I've tried to do in this book is bring together a couple of core ideas. One is this idea that we humans engage in a constant traffic of conversation with each other. But what I do then is place it in the context of the operation of our memory systems. We have to know each other. We have to know our personal pasts. We have to have imagination or exercise imagination regarding our futures. And all of these come together when we talk to each other. So without memory, our conversations would be oriented around the present because we can't interrogate our past. But paradoxically, we can't really have conversations about the future, because memory allows us to imagine the future. How do we know this? We know this because people who have damage to the parts of the brain that are concerned with memory suffer deficits in imagining. So if you ask them, what are you thinking at this moment? They'll tell you, and they can do this with great ease. Ask them about what they did last week. Can't really remember. Ask them what they're going to be doing next week or the week after next. And they'll say, pretty much what I'm doing now. They can't imagine alternative futures. We need memory in order to imagine different futures. And I think this is something that has only really become understood probably in about the past 10 years or so.
There's a word that's been used an awful lot in the last 5 years, which is narrative. You know, everything's about narrative now, whether it's politics or, you know, corporate advertising or, you know, literature. It's all about narratives. And I there's an increasing understanding in journalism that what people engage with are stories. You know, that it doesn't matter. You can do a report on statistics and the rest of it, and no one really listens to it. But you just tell one story about one person in that statistic, and people engage. What have you been concluding about the role of narrative and stories?
So I think this is a really good question in terms of how we've investigated memory. And it's not really until in the past 10 or 20 or so years that we've had the tools to allow us to investigate narrative. If you go back 100 years or more in the history of experimental psychology, a lot of the kinds of techniques that were used to probe memory focused on things like word lists, nonsense syllables, alphanumeric lists of one sort or another. So kind of memory without any context. And there's always been a bit of a pushback against that view of memory. Most famously, I think, with the Cambridge psychologist, Frederick Bartlett, who gave people passages to read, usually ones that would have been alien to their experience, and then would come back and ask them days or weeks or months later about the contents of those passages. And it turns out, actually, people are pretty good at learning word lists, but we're pretty good at forgetting them. So we forget about 70 or 80% of the word lists over a period of a few weeks to a few months. And we're pretty good at remembering narratives. But what we do is simplify the narrative. We extract a gist from it. And details that might be complex for us in terms of our own culture get translated into something that's much more familiar. So the stories tend to end up being simplified. And it's those simplified stories that we remember. And we do that in terms of our own personal story as well. So if you track children over time from, let's say, the age of 7 or 8 through to the age of maybe 18 or 20, and you get them to tell their personal autobiography repeatedly over that period of time, what they tell you changes, what they regard as important changes. So the first day in school might be something very important to an 8-year-old, or their last birthday might be a very important event. But by the time they're 16, those things are there if you probe them, but they're not the most salient within the story that they tell themselves. And we do carry around with us a kind of a personal autobiography. And this is at the core of our interactions with each other, because we ask each other stuff about our personal stories all the time. And we don't tend to say, well, I was born on the 10th of the 10th, 2010, or whatever it happens to be. You say, well, I'm 14 and I go to such and such a school and my parents are the following. In other words, we convert these bare bones things into a narrative, because that's the easiest way for another person to consume it.
Yeah, well, I guess when a child or a young person changes the story about their life, they're just selecting different true facts, right? So, I mean, it could all be true, but it's just that they're thinking some things are more important at different stages of their development. But
yeah, absolutely. And what is important depends on your age. And, of course, we have this phenomenon known as the reminiscence bump, where if you get people to recall across the course of their lives events that they can look back upon, you get a big bump in recall in the teen years and the early 20s when there's lots of change and there's lots of things happening, and it settles down a bit in the decades after. So you have this kind of intensification of development and intensification of social roles in particular that you engage in during your teenage years. And you get a consequent effect on memory, and in turn, that enriches the kind of conversation that you can have with others.
But we need to get onto false narratives and post-truth and all that. Because, I mean, one thing, I recently made a podcast about a hijack. And there were two passengers in, if you like, 1C and 1D, let's call it. You know, so they were on either side of the aisle at the front of the plane. And a man was shot dead between them. This is in 1981 in, where did that happen? Afghanistan. And this guy was shot dead, and they were within, let's say, 2 feet. And I interviewed them both and asked them to recall and describe it. And one said the body was taken to the front of the plane and thrown off, and the other said the body was taken to the back of the plane and thrown off. It was such a massive sort of difference on such an enormous event. I mean, to see someone killed right in front of you. I couldn't understand it, how the memory could have been that false. But I somehow, and I think I know which one of them misremembered it.
Yeah, and misremembering is very, very common, especially under stress. And this is something that we, again, terribly underestimate in society. Now, we've had in courts, of course, laws to do with and rules to do with how people are questioned. Leading questions, for example, are forbidden in the courtroom. And investigators have become wise to this over recent years. And we know in the US, for example, the Innocence Project has resulted in the freeing of many, many people who were misidentified on the basis of eyewitness evidence, because DNA evidence has now come to prove their innocence. I believe there's a very salient and recent case in the UK of a chap who spent, I think, 17 years in jail recently, again, on the basis of eyewitness evidence. And the reality is that just because something has happened beside you doesn't mean that you are paying necessarily deep attention to what was going on. Did you close your eyes? Did you drop your head? Was there a lot of movement around? Were you paying a lot of attention to the blood on the ground or whatever it happens to be? And in simulations where people probe people who are under simulated assault, what you find is people don't look at faces. They look at the knife. They look at the gun. They look away from the face of the person who is attacking them, because the face is not important. The hands are important. So there are things that we can be led astray by. And then, of course, we go back through memories and we replay them. And we may misremember a salient element. We may discuss it with somebody and that contaminates it. The person in the aisle on the left might have averted their head and spoken to the person beside them, and they've forgotten that they did that. They may have misperceived a movement. Who knows what? You don't have any kind of visual evidence. You know, there's no video recording to tell you exactly what that person was paying attention to at that time. And the problem is that the confidence that people have in their own memory and the what we might call the veridicality, the accuracy, the empirical accuracy of their memory can be two different things.
Yeah, I mean, I witnessed a car crash where someone was badly injured and gave a statement, and then the insurers all had a big fight about it. And it was about sort of 6 years later, I got asked by a court to describe what happened. And I have to say, I refused to do it. I said, look, I simply cannot remember it as well as I will have done in that statement taken immediately after the event. And so I'm not going to say anything except read out that statement, because how could I possibly remember it better 6 years later? And it seems to me that time plays a part in this. I mean, I have heard it said that as you recall an event, you can somehow lay down a new memory of it. And that's where the problem arises.
Both of those things are true. I think your urge not to go on the stand and give fresh evidence was the correct one. Because
they didn't like it. They didn't like it at all. They said, no, it's your obligation to do this. And I was like,
yeah, and just read out your contemporaneous statement.
Yeah.
You know, it's by far the better thing to do. And this is another thing. You've just hit on something very important, which I don't deal with directly in the book, but I do indirectly. And it's this idea that when you recall things, memories become labile and they can be overwritten. So I give an example of in the book of how when you repeatedly recall memories in a group context of a film that you've watched, where people that you're talking to deliberately, they're primed to do this, misremember an element of that memory, that you come to believe on about 60% of occasions what the group consensus is. So that means that there's an interaction between what you're recalling and what you're hearing. And the group consensus overrides the recall that you engage in. And there's a good reason for this. It goes back to this issue of trust that I mentioned at the start. We are bounded within our own heads and we trust in the judgment of others because we find ourselves regularly in situations where we're kind of pushing at the limits of our knowledge and we may not be certain. So going along with what the community knows is a very good way of getting by in our complex social worlds.
Yeah, conformity is a very powerful force.
Absolutely, yes.
Mm. What about this material you've got at the end of the book about the role of conversations in creating communities? So, I mean, you make the claim that nations are created basically by conversations. I'll push back in a minute on it a bit, but what's your idea about that?
Okay, so the idea is very straightforward, and it's based on the analysis of a nationalism that Benedict Anderson, the political scientist, engaged in. And it's this idea that nations at their core are kind of imagined communities. If you go back to the African plains, countries didn't exist. There were no borders in nature apart from physical borders. This is something that's the Westphalian kind of settlement is something that has happened over the last few hundred years. And it's a process that continues. Depending on the list that you look at, there have been maybe 20, 30 new countries have come into existence over the past 30 or so years. And the country that I'm in has been reshaped very considerably over the past century or so. I'm sure there will be changes to come again in the future. And the point is that the affinity that we as members of a nation feel toward each other is not a physical thing out there in the world. It's something that has to reside within a set of claims that we make about each other. In other words, it's something that we have to learn, and it's something that we express to each other over the course of our lives. Now, the claim that Anderson makes is that this kind of way of thinking about the world would have been impossible in the absence of the spread of literacy, in the absence of the spread of books, and the absence of the kind of the understanding of maps and history. So to my mind, these are all very cognitive ways of looking at the world. If we had brains that were designed slightly differently, if we were a little bit more like our chimpanzee cousins, we might be very territorial, but we would not be able to engage in the kind of widespread social organization that allows a city like Tokyo with 40 million people to exist. Or if we were like orangutans, the same would be true. We just would never come together apart from for reproduction. So we humans occupy this kind of cognitive sweet spot that allow us to mentalize together, to imagine futures together, to agree what the limits of our nation are and where our nation ends and where another nation begins.
Okay, well, I mean, that answer sort of, you know, it takes into account what I was thinking really a bit, which is it's not just conversation. You know, as you say, it's literature, it's art, it's documents, but I mean, you could add it's violence, it's economic power. You know, there are lots of factors that go into the creation of a community or a nation.
Oh, of course. But at the core, somebody has to sit down and say, this is ours, that's theirs, we're taking theirs. We want it to be ours. You know, these conversations between revolutionaries sitting around tables saying such and such an occupation or occupying force has to go. Who's with us? These kinds of conversations are core to how, as a community, we imagine together what our community should be. And we've seen this in country after country, time after time. You know, I've only read some of them, but the Federalist Papers is a really, really good example of a bunch of guys, and in that time it was guys, sitting around together imagining what a future nation could be. And that nation became the United States. And we see it when we look, again, just to be a bit more parochial, when you look back 120-odd years where Irish nationalism was concerned, again, it was conversations about what the nation should be. And the revival of the 1890s gave way to the revolution that subsequently occurred. And this happens all around the world, all the time. You see it in all sorts of places. So I think conversation is core to this, but it's not all.
Since you mentioned the US and Ireland, I get to just something occurred to me as after you'd mentioned it, which was that when you made your bilingualism point about, you know, speaking with a Chinese person, you know, if I was speaking with an American sharing a language or an Irish person sharing a language, there could still be difficulties me making the correct assumptions about what they're saying because or what they're thinking or about to say because of the cultural gap. I mean, that must be right.
Oh, that's true. And George Bernard Shaw recognized that, 100 years ago when he said the US and the UK are two countries divided by a common language.
Yeah, I guess that's his point. Yeah.
And we know this today when, in an economic context, when Europeans talk about liberalism, they mean something quite different to what Americans mean by liberalism. So these words are, to be maybe a slightly contentious example, when the EU talks about federalism and when the UK talks about federalism, we mean different things.
Now then, what surprised you most about the research? What was the moment when you went, gosh, I never thought that?
The moment actually was when I started writing the book, I was going to tell what I thought was going to be a fairly straightforward story about autobiographical memory and what it means to talk to others and to tell our personal stories. So this kind of self-reporting that we engage in all the time. And as I was writing the book, I had written quite a bit of material that fitted within that theme. So around ideas to do with investigative interviewing, for example, and a whole lot of other things like this. And that material has not ended up in the book because about halfway through, I started to think about some thought experiments. How would we construct a nation or a community around people who suffer from amnesia, for example? And the answer is you can't. And I then read Anderson's book, Imagine Communities. And I think that was the point at which the book changed direction, that it caused me to really think about how it is that we can get from having a skull full of neurons on the one hand to these amazing nations that we have on the other. There must be a continuity. There has to be. There's no other way for this to have happened. It has to be based around the ideas that we humans are cognitive agents. And I think that the key thing is kind of selecting the level of analysis. Thinking about nations in terms of neurotransmitters is a really stupid thing to do. What we need to do is to think about it at the appropriate level of analysis. And what's that level? Well, it's to do with imagination. It's to do with how we think about things together, how we work together as collectives, and how we can imagine the future and how we reinterpret our past. So choosing that level of analysis and then putting this book in that kind of context that there is a continuity between the brain full of neurons, as I've said, and the nations that we work in together.
Just finally, this series is called The Future Of, and I've always contrived on every single episode over a year now to find a way of talking about the future. But I'm struggling with this. I mean, what's the future of talking? It's just more talking, right?
Well, I suppose the future of talking is more talking, but I think we humans are very self-reflective and we can get better at talking. So I give some examples in the book. One is the idea of deep canvassing. One of the things that it is very difficult to do generally is to get people to change their minds about something. You know, there's the old line about how scientific theories die as their promulgators die rather than them being subject to empirical test, and how bad ideas in society die as their promulgators die. But what we can actually do, and I think the science of rapport and the kind of research around that shows that if we meet each other in a respectful way and we listen to what the other person is trying to say and try to understand where it is that they're coming from, we can actually have conversations that are very, very helpful and that can change the trajectory of a society. Now, that isn't just airy words. And I'll give two local examples. We've used in this country, in Ireland, citizens' assemblies in the last 8 to 10 years to change our constitution. And we have a series of them running at the moment where randomly selected members of the public with a chair, who's usually an outsider, have conversations in different places around the country with lots and lots of expert input and generate a report. And these are televised live, and the reports tend to be a matter of great national debate. And the two major constitutional changes that we had, the one on the right to marriage and the other on repealing the referendum on abortion, were both overturned, or were both voted on and favourably and decisively as a result of these deliberative assemblies. So we have ways of talking to each other. We should be willing to experiment with new ways. And these kinds of novel ways, deep canvassing on the one hand, where we listen respectfully, and citizens' assemblies on the other, where we really hear that actually the people were ahead of the politicians, can be really important ways of driving conversation in the future.
Well, thank you very much, Shane O'Mara, for talking to us about talking.
Thank you. That was really nice.